There is a red Ford with plate EKS334 that is parked across a driveway, and please move your vehicle or it will be towed, I'm told. So red Ford plate EKS334. Now let's come to the Lord's Word as we continue on in our series about the seven deadly sins. Today I want to tell you about a TV show that I come across every once in a while, mostly when I'm at the fitness club that I go to, because they now have TVs on the bikes that you can work out on. And this show is always on when I go to work out. It is called My 600-Pound Life. And it follows the lives of people who weigh 600 pounds or more. It describes itself like this: telling powerful stories, it follows medical journeys of people as they attempt to save their own lives. The featured individuals, each weighing more than 600 pounds, confront lifelong emotional and physical struggles as they make the courageous decisions to undergo high-risk surgeries and drastically change their appearance. They hope to reclaim their independence, mend relationships with friends and family, and renew feelings of self-worth. And I've watched a few segments of this show, and it does a very good job of not making fun of people. Instead, it documents the real struggles that they face. Many have lost their independence, and they need others to do their shopping for them, or they depend on others to drive them around. They are often confined to their own houses or apartments or even bedroom as they try to face this challenge in their lives. The show's been on air for 7 years, and you can look back over its history to see the names of the people featured and where they are at now in life. All weighed around 600 pounds when they first appeared on the show, but some weighed more. One young man named Sean Milliken weighed 919 pounds at the age of 26. He lost nearly 400 pounds to get to 548, but he sadly died at the age of 29. There was a Melissa Morris who at 31 weighed 653 pounds, but today weighs 240. So she'd lost over 400 pounds, but would still be considered overweight in our culture. And there's some amazing stories. Yet when I finish my time on the exercise bike, I can turn off that show and go back to my life. And I can think, well, those people's issues are far from my life. It has nothing to do with me. And I wonder if many of us might have the same reaction when we hear about the sin that we're talking about today, gluttony. But if we look a little deeper, we might discover that the root of this sin shows up in ways in our lives that we might never have thought about or recognized. And this is the second in a series of seven sins that we're going to talk about over the next weeks, and it continues our focus on God's transforming work in our hearts, in our lives. And last week I gave you the history of the seven deadly sins, and if you want to go back to the website to catch up on that, please do so. We started with pride last week, and we talked about God's ability to transform proud people into humble, God-centered people. And today we look at this gluttony. And we're going to look at it by asking three questions. One, what is gluttony? Two, what is the problem with gluttony or gluttonous attitudes? And three, how do we cooperate with God's transforming work in this area of our lives? So first of all, what is gluttony? And today, we think it solely refers to overeating. And we conclude that if I don't really have an issue with overeating, this has nothing to do with me. But we need to recognize that our eating habits can reveal what is going on in our hearts and in our minds. An out-of-control desire for food can be the avenue for sin in our lives. It can lead to big problems. And if you don't believe me, let's go back to the first three chapters of the Bible and the fall of man. How did that happen? Through food. But it wasn't really the food that was the problem. It was what Eve believed that the food promised. Eve saw the food represent much more than satisfaction for her physical hunger. Genesis 3:6 states, "So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And she also gave some to her husband who was with her." Jonathan Bowers, in his chapter on gluttony in the little book Killjoys, writes, "In the moment of temptation, the fruit embodied Eve's deepest cravings for pleasure, beauty, and wisdom. Eating the food was the means by which Adam and Eve sinned, but it was the desire for something much deeper that led to this action. So food can serve as a means to wrongly fulfill a desire. And one way this happens or shows up in our lives is through gluttony. A common dictionary definition would say it's simply excessive eating and drinking. But that only deals with one form of gluttony, and it's really the symptom. Tim Keller argues that gluttony has a much deeper definition, or needs a much deeper definition to get at the root of things. And it goes like this: gluttony is the inability to live a life of delayed gratification or satisfaction or fulfillment of desire. And remember, a desire is the feeling that accompanies an unfulfilled state. And we talked about desires back on January 20th. We learned that many of our desires are natural but distorted by sin, so we must invite God to reorder our desires and learn to satisfy them in God-honoring ways. And one common aspect of a God-honoring way to fulfill desires is to wait, to delay fulfillment of them until it's appropriate to satisfy them. But a gluttonous attitude says, "I don't have to wait to satisfy my desires. I can satisfy them now. I deserve to satisfy myself now." And when put this way, we can see how gluttony involves much more than food or drink. It's not just excessive eating or drinking. It can be excessive shopping or spending or drugs or escape activities or video gaming or sex or vacationing or TV or partying or gambling or thrill-seeking or pleasure-seeking. Tim Keller writes, "When the love of pleasurable physical sensation dominates, it is the deadly sin of gluttony." And I would add that when the need for some sort of emotional satisfaction dominates, we can enter into gluttony, which means, friends, that all of us can fall into a form of gluttony or have a gluttonous attitude. For me, this shows up in later evening snacking. Around 9:30, 10:30 at night, I can all of a sudden feel like I want something to eat. I look for crackers or Doritos are my favorite. I love Doritos or some other snack, but Lori, my wife, knows about this tendency. So do you know what she does? Hides the Doritos. And I know that she's doing it for my good, but when I get hungry or want a snack late at night, I am not very happy that Lori has done this to me. And sometimes I do find the stash of Doritos or crackers, and then I eat a bunch. But why? I'm not really hungry. It's almost become a routine of celebration or reward that I came through another day. And the next morning, I don't know about you, but this has happened to me. When I wake up and I have food in my stomach that was eaten just before bed, I don't feel good. Gluttony is this inability to delay gratification. And in that case, I am a glutton. I act like a glutton. But you still might say, is it really that big of a deal? If it were such a problem, the government would make buffets illegal. Well, let's turn to the Bible for some answers. And the first passage is Proverbs 23, verses 19 to 21. So Proverbs 23, verses 19 to 21. And you can follow along in the Bibles in front of you if you don't have one, page 471. "Hear, my son, and be wise, and direct your heart in the way. Be not among drunkards or among gluttonous eaters of meat, for the drunkard and the glutton will come to poverty, and slumber will clothe them with rags." So this introduces us to one of the problems of gluttony, The first problem is it can lead to financial instability, which can lead to many other problems. A person who spends a lot of money on food and drink can cause financial problems for themselves or their family, and this can especially happen with excessive drinking, because when you get drunk, you can do a lot of damage, get in accidents, have a lawsuit brought against you, break up a marriage, which is hugely cost or has a huge cost. Excessive eating and drinking can lead to financial hardship, but it can also show up in other areas. Excessive shopping or spending can put families in debt for years. Excessive pursuit of entertainment or vacations can burn up savings or rainy day funds. Gluttonous behavior can lead to financial instability, unnecessary hardship. Another problem with gluttony is it seeks happiness directly, but it often results in us feeling worse or guilty afterwards. Proverbs 21:17 states, "He who loves pleasure will become a poor man. He who loves wine and oil will not become rich." So in that verse, we again see the financial impact, but notice that the person loves pleasure. So they aim to do something for the sole purpose of experiencing pleasure or happiness. They may take whatever shortcut is necessary to get there, and it almost always comes with a negative cost. So say you, one evening or one weekend, are looking for pleasure, and you want it now. So you go to one of six possible sources to get it: drinking, going to a party, having sex, or watching porn, watching TV or gaming late into the night, snacking, or going to buy something. So you go to one of these six with the purpose of experiencing pleasure or happiness immediately. So you get a drink, and you might experience some relief or some happiness, except life is not going so well, so the next time that you want to experience pleasure or happiness, you get two drinks, and three, and then four, and five. And you get immediate happiness, but you might lose your job, because you can't show up for work, or your family has to deal with the consequences of your behavior when you're drunk. Or say you're in school and it's hard and there's a big test coming up, but you want to experience pleasure, so you ditch studying and go to the party and you get some immediate happiness, but this becomes a pattern and you fail the course or the degree. Or you see on the movies, or you hear about your friends sleeping around and they're having so much fun, so instead of waiting until marriage, you decide, "I'm going to do it now," and you may experience some immediate gratification and satisfaction, but then it doesn't work out with that person. And you carry that intimate experience and brokenness into the next relationship, and then into the next one, and into your marriage. Or you don't quite go to the extent of actually sleeping around, but you mess around with porn, like you have multiple fantasies, and then you have to bring that into your marriage and all the baggage that that brings along. Or instead of shutting off the TV or computer or device, you game or watch TV or look at your phone until 2:30 or 3 in the morning, and you experience this immediate satisfaction or happiness. But then you are sleep deprived, and you don't function well the next day, and you lack patience for just the daily irritants of life. Or like me, instead of saying no to snacking, you say yes and you get immediate satisfaction, but you may feel worse later or gain weight that was lost. Or you're out shopping and you see a TV or a couch or a car or a coat or a dress on sale and you buy it right away and you experience immediate satisfaction, except you couldn't afford it. And it turns out to be not as great as promised, and now you've got to spend the next 6 months or 6 years paying for it. And we might say, well, yeah, that's all true, but at least we get to experience some happiness, some satisfaction for a few moments, and that's better than nothing. But living God's way promises a much deeper happiness than the passing pleasures of a moment or a day. God's way involves living responsibly and then enjoying the fruits of that responsible living. It doesn't place pleasure as its goal. God calls us to live responsibly and then experience the lasting joys and happiness of that kind of living. So instead of going to drink, you show up for work at your best, which can lead to job promotions or progress or further opportunities. Instead of going to the party, you keep studying, and most of the time, intense study leads to passing of the course, and more opportunities and maybe deeper satisfaction in work opportunities. You wait for intimacy until marriage, which can lead to the deep gift of presenting yourself to that one that God brings to you. Or turning off the TV, computer, or phone at a decent hour and then getting a good night's sleep can lead to the deeper happiness of good relationships and of being fully engaged at work or at school and bearing with the irritants of life in a way that glorifies God because you have the reserves to do so. Or waiting to purchase until you have saved the amount can lead to the happiness that comes when you actually test your desire for that purchase. And you spend some time researching it and discovering, oh, that one isn't so great, but this one is better. And we're saving. And yes, through that time of testing, all of a sudden we have the money, we can buy it, and we don't feel any guilt or have a burden hanging over us. Gluttony pursues happiness or pleasure directly, often leaving us feeling worse or guilty later. But God-centered, responsible, delayed gratification living can lead to a lasting happiness that helps us to feel better or leaves us feeling better without guilt as time goes on. But we're encouraged to seek happiness and gratify our desires instantly all over in our culture, aren't we? Tim Keller writes, "There has never been a society like ours where the powerful forces of media, marketing, and culture urge us to gratify our desires for comfort and pleasure now." So gluttony can lead to financial instability. It can take the shortcut to happiness that often leaves us feeling worse later. The third problem with gluttony is it presents a disguised solution to stress, anxiety, and unhappiness that often leads to more problems. And we learn this from Proverbs 23, verses 29 to 35. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has strife? Who has complaining? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? Those who tarry long over wine, those who go to try mixed wine. Do not look at wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup and goes down smoothly. In the end, it bites like a serpent and stings like an adder. Your eyes will see strange things and your heart utter perverse things. You will be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea, like one who lies on the top of a mast. They struck me, you will say, but I was not hurt. They beat me, but I did not feel it. When shall I awake? I must have another drink. So this is talking about a drunken person. Verse 29 kind of warns of the danger. It asks that question, who has woe, sorrow, strife, complaining, wounds without cause, and redness of eyes? That doesn't sound like a very happy existence, does it? But it is the person who tarries long over wine, over those who go to try mixed wine. So this is not saying you may never have a drink of wine. But it is saying looking at wine or at drink as if it is the solution to life's issues or dealing with life is a problem. I remember we had in our church in Ottawa, we had an Alcoholics Anonymous group that met there. And I remember meeting with the guy as he was wanting to see if they could use our facility. And I never forget what he said. Our problem as alcoholics is 25% drink and 75% with how we deal with life. And so this is, we have to keep this in mind. It's not saying you may never have a drink of wine, but if you look to wine or drink, well, as your hope, that's a problem. And then it warns again in verse 32, in the end it bites like a serpent and stings like an adder. And then it begins to describe what the experience of the drunk person is. Your eyes will see strange things. You know how people, when they're drunk, they can be seeing weird things or saying that they're seeing weird things and strange things. And they have these responses that they can't control. Some drunks experience delirium tremens or DTs, where they just can't stop shaking. A professional golfer, John Daly, that happened to him on national TV one time. I remember watching the tournament, and all of a sudden he was on a green, and he could not stop shaking. And in talking with people whose family members struggle with alcohol, the end of verse 33, your heart will utter perverse things, rings so true. They have to deal with brutal speech and abusive speech when people or their family members, some of them are drunk. But then maybe verse 35 is the saddest. They struck me, you will say, but I was not hurt. They beat me, but I did not feel it. Almost like the drunk is saying, well, you know, being drunk was a good thing because when they struck me, I wasn't hurt. When I got beaten, I didn't feel it. Wasn't that good? I was drunk when, in fact, maybe if you weren't drunk, you wouldn't be in that situation in the first place. And then at the end, he says, when shall I awake? Not so I can sober up, not so I can live responsibly, but I must have another drink. And Keller writes, drink or any other food can become a deep consolation, a way to find relief from anxiety. The insatiable need sharpens over time, but the addict is helpless. Overcoming addiction is never simple and can take a lifetime, but Paul was right when he pointed to the ultimate consolation we need. Ephesians 5:18, do not get drunk on wine, but be filled with the Spirit. Being filled with the Spirit means to see Christ vividly, joyfully. And this joy makes it possible to cast aside other disguised forms of consolation. And leads us to the last problem that I'm going to get to today, the biggest problem with gluttony. It replaces God with something else as our supreme treasure. We might think, well, that's an overstatement. That could never really happen. Well, let's go to Philippians 3:17-19. The Apostle Paul writes this, brothers, join in imitating me and keep your eyes on those who walk according to the example you have in us, for many of whom I have often told you and now tell you even with tears, walk as enemies of the cross of Christ. Their end is destruction. Their God is their belly, and they glory in their shame with mind set on earthly things. Gluttony is no joke. It can lead people to hell. And this text teaches us that we can put food or anything else that we turn to excessively for comfort and hope in the place of God. And when we treat them like an end in themselves, we ruin our appetite for fellowship with God. Well, that's enough on the problem. Let's focus on a solution. I was trying to think about what is the opposite of gluttony. So last week we were talking about pride. It's pretty obvious. The opposite of pride is humility. What's the opposite of gluttony? And I looked up in a dictionary, and you know how they have the synonyms sometimes, and then the antonyms, the opposite. Well, for gluttony, the opposite is nibbler, picker, or dieter, which doesn't quite deal with the depth of what we're talking about here, does it? God can transform proud people into humble people. God can transform gluttons into nibblers. No, I don't think that has it. So here's my best shot. God can transform, so that's off slide 5 there. Slide 5. God can transform instant happiness-seeking gluttons into deeper happiness-experiencing worshipers by his gospel. So God can transform instant happiness-seeking gluttons into deeper happiness-experiencing worshipers by his gospel. How? How do we cooperate with God's transforming work in this area of our lives? Well, first of all, we need to ask for Jesus' help for self-control. Jesus is our greatest and our biggest help. And did you know that Jesus himself was called a glutton? He's talking to John the Baptist's disciples. They're reporting from John, who is in prison and is pretty disappointed about the way things have worked out. If they've asked, is Jesus, are you really the one? Because perhaps they thought, you know, John has done his job. He's been a forerunner to the Messiah, and he's going to get some recognition for that. Or at least everyone's going to recognize that Jesus is the Messiah, and this victorious kingdom is going to come in with power. But John's in prison. So what's going on, Jesus? And Jesus responds, well, yes, the kingdom has come, but it's not going to unfold like you thought, and few will recognize it. In fact, you can see that by the way people have responded to you, John, and the way they respond to me. So Matthew 11, verses 18 and 19, this is Jesus talking, and he says, for John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say he has a demon. So here's John the Baptist. He's the forerunner. He's not eating or drinking because of his vows, and people say, not, hey, here's the forerunner. It's he has a demon. And then Jesus says, the Son of Man came eating and drinking. So unlike John, he did eat and drink. And they say, look at him, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Jesus is called a glutton. He wasn't a glutton, though he did eat and drink with those rejected by the religious leaders, but he knows what it's like to be called a glutton, and he died and atoned for gluttony. And when we cooperate with Christ, we can ask the Holy Spirit to grow his fruit of self-control in us, and we pray to the one, Jesus, who was the very embodiment of self-control because he regularly put himself in situations where there was gluttony and drunkenness, but never sinned. And you can, and I can overcome the spiritual hold that some of these areas have on us by the Spirit's power. And sometimes God delivers in an instant, and a life is turned around, and you can leave behind those things that you turn to for consolation. But we've seen through Proverbs that the scriptures teach us that the parts of a person are interrelated, physical, spiritual, psychological, emotional. And sometimes God brings spiritual healing that can then contribute to the overall healing or wholeness of the person. And it takes time. But we can at least start by praying for the Lord to grow that fruit of self-control in our lives. And then we need to ask God to help us identify the needs behind our gluttonous behavior. So ask God to help you identify the need you're trying to satisfy with your gluttonous behavior. So a great prayer to pray is Psalm 139, verses 23 and 24. Search me, O God, and know my heart. That's an invitation for God to search and sift our hearts. Try me and know my thoughts. See if there be any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. So pray that prayer. And then maybe sit down with a piece of paper and write down anything that might qualify for this lovely label of gluttonous behavior in your life. What do you do to excess that might feel good in the moment but leaves you feeling worse or less human or guilty later? Ask the Lord, help you identify that. It could be something like this excessive drinking or eating or excessive time on TV or video games or your phone or shopping or vacationing or maybe obsessively following a celebrity. And then ask the Lord to reveal to you the motivation behind your behavior. What need or desire is driving this behavior? It could be a need for security or escape or consolation or an attempt to make the pain stop, or to feel accepted, or to satisfy at least something on a day that has been pretty frustrating. But then we need to realize that each of these needs can find its deepest satisfaction in Jesus. So this is the end point. Find satisfaction for these needs in the Lord. Psalm 62, 1. My soul finds rest in God alone. My salvation comes from him. He alone is my rock and my salvation. He is my fortress. I will never be shaken. And when we need security, the Lord is our rock and salvation. When we think we need to escape, we don't. Because no matter what we're facing, Jesus stands right beside us and will walk with us through it. When we need consolation, the Lord is near to those who are brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. When we're in pain, we remember he experienced pain like no one else will ever experience, bearing the wrath of God on the cross for our sins, not his. And when we need acceptance, God's the only one who knows everything about us and still loves us and accepts us. And when we need satisfaction after a day of frustration, the Lord constantly pursues us with goodness and mercy every day and satisfies us in the morning with his unfailing love. We need to grow in finding satisfaction in God and his love for us, no matter what else happens. And these are pieces in the battle against gluttonous behavior in our lives. And as we come to the Lord's table today, what a tremendous opportunity to make war on gluttonous behavior. Because we're not going to be gorging ourselves on food. It's an opportunity to practice self-control. You're coming together with brothers and sisters. When we're served, we wait until everyone is served. We're served a very little, yet we are reminded ultimately our hope and our life is not in food, but in Christ himself. God can transform instant happiness-seeking gluttons into deeper happiness-experiencing worshipers by his gospel. And as a fellow glutton, I invite you to join me now at his table to celebrate that possibility and reality.